Hello and welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a weekly podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
We're pleased to be joined by Jacinda Shelley of Apro Health. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here, Will and Carlton.
We're thrilled to have you on. I've been a fan from afar of your talks and some of your writings. So maybe to jump right in, could you tell us how you got into Django, and then we can talk about all the cool stuff you've been doing with it?
Django specifically was as a result.
Or Python, you can give us the origin story as short or as long as you like.
Okay, I'll try and keep it compressed, and then we can expand if we want to. I started learning to program in Python when I was at MIT, actually, right after they switched their introductory computer science course. I was a transfer student there when they made the transition from Scheme to Python. And so that's where I first got into Python and loved the language, and was fortunate enough that the first job I had after university was at a place where all of our backend code was in Python. And our front ends for the web applications were in JSP and Java server faces at the time. But a couple years in, got the chance to sort of rework that for a different prototype project. And we worked with Django. And then my husband, who's also a programmer, used Django for a side project. And so we both started working with it, I think around 1.2 or 1.3 back in 2011, 2012.
Okay, that's back in the day. I'm curious, what does a backend not written in a framework look like with Python? Was it using something else, or is it just sort of raw from scratch, the first job?
It was a sort of from scratch JSON RPC API interface.
And what was in connecting? What do you remember? What type of database was it, like MySQL or?
It was originally MySQL, and then we transitioned to Postgres. We were using mod Python with Apache at the time.
Okay. Doctor on Demand, where you were, was Django from the beginning. Is that correct?
Yes. That was the first project where I was lucky enough to get to choose the stack. And I was honestly quite nervous about building something completely from scratch.
yeah.
No constraints.
No constraints, really. And got to choose Django.
But it is such a different beast. Like, I've been really struck by the fact that, yeah, I mean, your average, Django engineer expert, you almost never get to start something from scratch. And so it's not that you don't know where the pieces are, but a number of people I certainly look up to have pinged me being like, oh, I was, I'm doing a side project and I haven't done one for a couple of years, and I was trying to do something, and I looked up a post by you, and I'm like, oh, really? You looked up something by me? Like, you're this genius. Anyways, the different spheres, and the startup phase is a different one. But I totally agree. Like, it also does feel like this burden of like, oh, I don't want to, like, I'm almost done with a relatively big project on my end, and I'm totally overthinking it because I'm like, oh, I should architect it perfectly, right, with what I know. There is that balance between like just
right.
Ship it too.
That's always the balance, right? Is like, I definitely felt this pressure, like everything I did was kind of going to cascade down. But then I also eventually realized that if it did cascade down, that would mean that people were actually using it. And so it's, if you're lucky enough to have technical
right.
debt
it's
down the
problem.
Road, it means that something went right on the business end.
Oh, no, I've got scaling
problems.
Nobody
cares about technical debt on an unsuccessful project.
Yeah, right.
Right. Well, I think, too, I've started to think more and more about the patterns and the fact that it does sometimes seem like some things are easier to change than others. But, yeah, at the end of the day, like, it's all code. It can all be changed. It's just some things take a little more effort than others. So maybe I've gone full circle. Well, I've been like, oh, I really don't want to have to back in these things if I don't, over-engineered up front. And then it's like, well, just to your point, though, it's like, it's all fixable and no one talks about technical debt and something that failed. So
that said,
I
did like
debt.
At the time that I started, it was right when Audrey and Danny were publishing the first edition of Two Scoops of Django, and so I had an early review copy of that, and basically used it as like a checklist of everything that I needed to keep in mind. Like I read the book essentially cover to cover and then took notes on all of the things that I needed to make sure to keep in mind as I was building out the initial product. And I have to say that helped a lot. And their book was something that as the team grew, we actually would buy for engineers coming on board, because we're like, yeah, we don't do absolutely everything in here, but if you use this as a starting point, then you'll have at least a solid foundation.
Yeah, I think that was the first Django book that I like read more than once and really enjoyed. And actually, I got into publishing as a book editor, and they like had a whole bunch of like typos, and I actually sent them, and they were really sweet. They had problems with its and its, and they sent me like an autographed copy after, and so I was such a fanboy. I was like, oh my god, you know, these crazy people did this thing. But it was such, I agree, it's like, it's basically the Bible still. I mean, and I think, you know, even though they haven't updated it, it's still on 111. I hope that they do, because the advice is, you know, 90% of it hasn't changed in terms of being rock solid.
I definitely bought the new editions as they came out. And it's funny you mentioned like a typo. Like I got it like just a couple months before they published it, but I did find like one typo. So I think my name is right at the end for the first edition because of that. And I was like, this doesn't seem like enough. Just finding one typo should not be a reason that my name isn't.
Oh yeah, I think I'm in there too. It's a really nice, now that I'm thinking about it, because it's a really nice thing to do. I think I did on my first book, I had a whole bunch, but now there have been so many people catching so many things, I sort of stopped doing that. But anyways, but on architecture, I'm curious, so Doctrine and Demand, so you just started it and then it grew to this massive thing. I guess the other thing I've been thinking about recently is, I mean, there is no architecture that starts small and scales all the way up. Like it has to change. So I'm curious, what if you can look back and think of like, yeah, what were those big changes in terms of architecture? Or what were there some tipping points where you said, oh, we need to change how we structure our apps to larger things around, I don't know, what were the things, right? Because that's such an amazing journey to go from like the initial lines of code to like a large code base with a lot of engineers.
Yeah, it was.
Most people, I think, don't get to do
it
that.
It was an incredible journey. I was super fortunate to get to work with like really incredible people and stay long enough that I saw the team go from like myself and the two mobile engineers who started right after I did, all the way to like, they have about 50 engineers now and, handle thousands of video visits a day. interestingly enough, whether by luck or, probably mostly luck and like copying people who I admired, large portions of the architecture are still the same. Like it's still a Postgres database. And I think one of the things that helped in scaling was, trying to like use things in the way that made sense for them. So like we use Postgres for relational things. But then also make really heavy use of Redis for things where Redis makes more sense. So like caching, simple key value stores, and then a lot of the priority queues are done in Redis because Redis makes that really easy, but it can also be persistent, which queuing is a big part of the backend architecture at Doctor on Demand, because you imagine like people are waiting to see a doctor, and the routing mechanism there is based on the state that the patient is located in. So in the US, you have to be routed to a doctor that's licensed to practice in the state that you're located in. So we have to do a lookup. We do a geolocation lookup to find out where you are and then match you to a doctor that's licensed in your state. One of the things that is an interesting story, I think, is premature over-optimization and not doing some simple math ahead of time. I over-engineered the original version of how we route patients. So I think you had a reference in some of our notes to the first talk that I gave on like how we were using Celery. And one of the things that I did early on was like, well, if we need to scale to like every state, it probably makes sense for like every state to have its own Celery queue. But that got really unwieldy whenever providers had multiple state licenses in terms of like tracking when doctors were and weren't available in different states, if they could see patients across multiple states and tracking the state there. Turns out that even at like massive scale, the scale at which humans need to see doctors is sufficient to just run through a single process. So later, like after someone was like, so how scalable would this have to be even in like your wildest dreams? And I did some back of the envelope math and I was like, yeah, that's fast for a human, but for Python to be routing, like you could handle basically all the patients, like even if 1% of everyone in the US was sick and needed to see a doctor over a single 24-hour period, you can run it through one routing system and it's totally fine. And when I realized that, I was like, oh, well, this is a lot simpler now and actually a lot more stable and kind of automatically fixed a lot of bugs. So it's not the typical scaling story, actually, where it was like I made a realization that I'd overcomplicated something and then simplified it.
I think that's really cool. I think that's more typical than you say, though. I like that we, you know, you read, high scalability or whatever, and you think, oh, I've got to build a system like this. But I think 95, 98, 99% of web apps have exactly this kind of phenomenon where actually a simple stack, and you might get a slightly bigger server, but one of them's enough, and a slightly bigger database, but you don't need, you know, redundancy. And that's a common story. I think, you know, you see these blog posts, will Django scale? Yeah, it does. It will scale more than you need.
Yes. If you get to the point where you're worrying about it scaling, that's a good problem to have. And if you're having trouble scaling Django with a site that has less than, you know, hundreds of thousands of visitors a day, there's probably something in your configuration or your code that's the issue. It's not Django. That was the other thing, was keeping an eye on queries, because like database and like always learning about how the ORM works and when it makes queries, and the single biggest thing that helped in not having to like shard or like do crazy things with the database is just making sure that the queries were efficient. And that the ORM was used correctly.
Are there any examples you can give? So, I mean, prefetch, select related, jump out, but what were, what are like next level?
Prefetch and select related, but then also realizing that like iterating over a query set as opposed to like pulling all of the values at once can be a big time saver on certain tables, depending on what you're storing, like only can be really valuable. Especially if you have certain columns that store like large amounts of data. So you can either like use only or exclude certain columns. That can be an easier way to eke out performance than like trying to redo the whole schema. And keeping an eye on like, and using Django debug toolbar was always super helpful. Anytime I saw that there were like 1,000 queries coming from like a single API endpoint or a single web page, I was like, There's something not right here.
Yeah, it's like an N+1. Or I was going to ask, beyond Django debug toolbar, but then we're probably getting to monitoring tools, because I find Django debug toolbar gets me a lot of the way there. And if there's a problem, like, so I guess, did you have rules of thumb for beyond seeing, oh, there's 1,000 queries, like just looking and saying, oh, this feels slow? Like, how did you, when you have so many things you have to deal with on a growing platform, like what jumped out as you is like, oh, this deserves to be optimized versus something else? Because I think that'd be like, that's a really interesting question when you're in charge of the tech stack. How do you decide, or what jumps the
early
queue
on
of, yeah,
the this feels slow thing was a reasonably good benchmark, to be honest. But also over time, we put in place monitoring So our architecture was such that because we actually launched on mobile before web, we kind of got a clean separation between front end and back end, because the iOS and Android platforms were using an API. So when we added on a web browser, it was just like, okay, this is going to be a single page web app that is using the exact same API. So at the API endpoint level, we tracked how long on average each endpoint took to respond. And then we could evaluate, like, and we had some rule of thumb thresholds based on, we definitely didn't always follow these, especially for certain endpoints that weren't used as often. Like, I think the part of me that is like the engineering purist was like, no, we should have a threshold where like no API endpoint can go above this. And then the other part of me that was thinking about the business from the startup was like, there are other things that are more valuable that we could be working on, and this is good enough. And that's always a tough balance. But monitoring that the API response time, average time, got us a long portion of the way there.
That's pretty forward thinking to be mobile first. Yes. Back in, was that 2013, I think you said? Or I mean, because now that's sort of I would say standard practice, but that, I think even then, right? I mean, iPhone had only been out, well, I guess 4 or 5 years, but was that a big decision to make? Or like, I mean, because that's very prescient, but I don't think that was the case really back then, that you would default
this
to
is,
that.
This is one case where I definitely can't take credit. Our CEO at the time was like, we're launching on mobile and we're not going to do browser first, I think for a few different reasons. Because we were trying to be next generation was probably part of it. But also it ended up being that, yeah, that's one where actually the requirement came from outside of me. And I was like, okay, cool, I'll design around that. And so I can't really take any credit for that.
From my experience, I did app, mobile app development around that time, and that was like the mobile app gold rush days. That, you know, 2013, 2014, people were like, "Oh, I've got an idea for an app." You couldn't go anywhere without people telling you their app idea and expecting you to build it for free. It was crazy.
Equity, Carlton. Equity.
Yeah, no, but and don't get me started on that. That's all scars from the past. But
yeah, well, and I assumed you used Django REST framework. Is that correct?
You know, this is actually a funny story. We did not. And
oh, okay. Interesting.
And there was a transition to using REST later. It certainly stemmed from the previous job that I had where we were using JSON RPC. And so I was very familiar with RPC. And because partly in my head, it was like, oh, this is my... there is like some tight coupling in terms of state between the client and the server, where it was important to be tracking what state a call connection, like a video call connection, was in over time and like the progress. Certainly, looking back, it's one of the things where it's like, oh, I wish I had started with Django REST framework, but I didn't have experience with it, and I did have experience with JSON RPC and had used it previously, and it worked sufficiently well that it lasted for a long time. I think also at the time, and this was probably my own inexperience just with the community and the framework, honestly, where I remember that DRF was, I think there was a Kickstarter project in 2013, and so I was like, oh, they're making this big transition. I don't know if I want to do something right on this transition. Or it felt like that without digging deeper into it.
Do you have insight, Carlton, on what that...
Tom Christie last week, and he was going over the history. And yeah, that time, that transition from 2 to 3 or 1 to 2.
I think it was 1 to 2.
Yeah, 1 to 2 in the Kickstarter there. And yeah.
Yeah. I also vaguely remember thinking that I might want to do the entire API in engineering idealist terms. Like, well, if I do it in JSON RPC, then there's a potential that I could do it entirely over WebSockets and like not be tied to REST-based constraints, which in some part of my mind seemed very appealing.
But you're syncing, like, so you've got real-time syncing between the client, the mobile client app and the API backend, right? So I was going to ask you, how are you handling that kind of communication on the backend? The backend?
That was actually one of the first places where we used Redis. So I had a poor man's state machine. James Bennett works at Doctor On Demand now, and he can probably like laugh at my first implementation of this, which was, I mean, it lasted long enough, but it was like, I could have done it so much better.
Right, but that's always true. That's software, right?
So we use Redis to track the state that a doctor was in, and that was tied to like a call ID. We never did the actual real-time video. We were forward-thinking enough to, and I had experience like building out video infrastructure at a smaller scale, and so I was very pleased when the founders were like, yes, we already have a company that we're using that you just have to interact with their API for the actual video part. So we just had to track the state of a call, and it would transition from, you know, like someone makes a request that they want to talk to a doctor, and then the doctors have to be paged, and then they can either accept or reject a call. If they accept, then the call goes into a connecting status and the video connection happens like peer-to-peer. And then once it's confirmed as being connected, then it moves into like, okay, the call is now in progress. And so that status was tracked in, like the state for each doctor was stored in Redis, since it had to be updated frequently and was more of a key value entity. But also kind of needed to be persistent if a call got disconnected or someone came back later or something like that.
And so I'm on my mobile phone and I'm a patient and the doctor's accepted my call and I'm in the connecting state. How were you like polling, or were you using what were you doing to communicate the connection state back to the back end just from the client? Because that's kind of
the back end.
That's kind of the tricky question.
The back end was the arbiter of all state. Which was actually a good decision. So the client, if it did get connected, it would have to ask the server what state the call was in. Then as state transitions happened, that was where we used WebSockets. So, and push notifications. So say you were the patient and, you made a call, your call, once a doctor accepted, we'd use the WebSocket connection to push a notification to the client that the call had been accepted, with information on like what state it was now in. And then the client, if it hadn't received a push notification in a while, it could use polling as a backup mechanism because polling was much more expensive.
Okay. Yeah. You got the whole HTTP overhead and all of that.
Yeah.
Super. That's really interesting. So, it's, you know, I don't know how it comes across on the podcast, but that's super interesting.
Yeah, I don't know exactly like how getting into that level of detail will come across on the podcast. But the other thing that we used that was successful once I got the configuration working was Celery, from the perspective of using scheduled events. So if there needed to be timeouts on something, like... if something hadn't happened in 2 minutes, using Celery for that was a very successful choice. Although from an infrastructure perspective, like could also be frustrating at times because it has so many little knobs in terms of configuration that the first few times that I started using it, there were some deadlocks that happened at like 11:30 and I was the only person on call, and that interrupted like a trip to New York. Definitely have to thank my husband for being very patient that first winter after we launched, where I was like, yeah, I need to go find a Starbucks and get Wi-Fi, because I would get text message alerts on my phone if any like errors that happened.
So speaking of that, what was it like scaling up the team? Because you said there's now something like 50 engineers. I guess in terms of, I don't necessarily want to get into the hiring because that's this whole old topic, but for you being the, like, letting go and then managing people. Mm-hmm. That's always, I mean, that's a super deep topic, but what are your, I don't know, what are your sort of rules of thumb that you take away from that, that you're now applying to your new startup, right? Because especially the first time, it's such a, I mean, there's so many balls in the air you have to juggle to keep something going, bring on new people, find stuff for them to do, let go of certain things, all that.
Yeah, the balance between like letting go and implementing has always been challenging for me. And actually, like, this is the sort of like third kind of sine wave in my career. I think I'm a little bit unusual in terms of engineers in that, like, I actually also enjoy the management piece of it. But I get a little bit antsy sometimes if I haven't done code. So, at my first job, I started as, an engineer. I was actually hired as an engineer, and it was also a very small company. I showed up on my first day and they were like, by the way, you're now leading this team. You have one person reporting to you, and, you need to hire someone else. And I was like, wait, what? I remember this was my first, job after college.
What's a vote of confidence?
It was a terrifying vote of confidence, to be honest. Like, it's like, what are you thinking? But was able to like expand in scope of responsibilities and always enjoyed like organizing projects and like figuring out how different people could fit into pieces together. But after that job, I wanted something more hands-on for a while. So that's why one of the reasons why Dr. On Demand was very attractive as like a first engineer, because I was excited to be very hands-on again. The trickiest thing for me in scaling a team was learning to get, I think, the same sort of dopamine rush that you get from getting a piece of code to work from helping other people build systems that would let them get code to work, and thinking of it.
Right. It's a longer term thing.
And it's definitely a, I don't know if it's entirely a personality difference or like some people I think just naturally seem to be better at it than others. It's always been something that's been challenging for me to let go more of.
I think some people get a little tired of coding. So, I mean, I think part of it is, and maybe it's an idea that, you know, effective technical managers do oscillate between, you know, rolling up their own sleeves and managing others. But yeah, it's hard to say. It's one of those, I just read that book, Technical Managers, just came out 2 or 3 years ago, talking about, all these things and all these tensions from the woman who was CTO of, I think it was Rent the Runway.
Oh, cool.
And there is no, anyways, my quick takeaway is there is no person who has like a perfect equilibrium on this thing. I mean, the very things that make you a good engineer are the kind of things that make you go, you know, maybe sometimes not want to deal with other people's issues. But then if you are the type of person who can see that helping others, you know, is a magnifier and also in some ways feels better than your own individual stuff. So yeah, I haven't seen anyone with an answer. Carlton, I don't know what your thoughts on the matter are.
Cool. I live a hermit lifestyle for a reason. Like, you know,
you're an IC for life.
Yeah, no, I do like mentoring. I do like helping other people and work in a team environment, you know, to help on other people reach it. I see that it's great, but do I choose to do that as my main thing? No, I don't choose to do that as my main thing.
Yeah. Well, it's impressive that you've been able to do both, because it's either one is a lot of work, and to do both 3 times now, yeah, not for the faint of heart. So I do want to talk about your current thing, and maybe we can transition to that, you know. So round three, like, tell us, what is Apero Health? What's been different, you know, on the technical side versus Doctor on Demand, having gone through that journey?
Apero Health is a medical billing startup. So probably tackling a challenge that, you know, it sounds terribly boring. But if we get,
I mean, it's very relevant. I think anyone of a certain age is just dealing this all the time. If you have family, it's just I understand the problem.
But I was exposed to the problem when I was at Doctor on Demand, because originally we only took cash pay. which was very straightforward.
Oh,
when we started accepting insurance, things got an order of magnitude more complicated than I expected. And we were working with an outsourced medical billing partner who was supposed to handle a lot of the complexities. And so watching the way that they operated, I started thinking about like 2 or 3 years ago, I was like, this seems like an area that there's just not overlap between people who really understand software and who also really understand billing, because they both take, I think, a lot of time to fully understand the complexities. Interestingly, my husband had been looking at like various ideas because he wanted to found something of his own. He has a connection with a family medical practice, and I was like, well, for Doctor on Demand, this is a big pain point. Maybe you should talk to your family's practice and see what it's like for them. And I was not. This was several years ago. There were like so many things that I wanted to do at Doctor on Demand that I was like, yeah, it's not something that I can work on right now. But I think there's definitely like problems that could be fixed there. So he started looking into that. Also was looking into other ideas. So it didn't really go anywhere for a while. Was working on Apero, and then eventually came back to it. And he had been working on this since the end of last year, and was accepted into YC, which is kind of when I decided that it was something that I also wanted to pursue. So one of the differences so far has been like, yes, we're still using Django. But one of the differences has been like coming into a project that already has like a significant amount of engineering work that was done before I got there. And also like I, until really the last month, had been much more in operations and sales and wasn't even like touching the code. So that was a whole other exercising a different part of my brain.
I'm just thinking of the dynamic of like not just looking at someone else's code, but a spouse's code. I can't even imagine.
What is this rubbish?
It goes both ways, right?
Yeah.
So it's also with Django. Is it also Postgres? Like, what's the quick kind of stack that Apro's using?
Django, Postgres, running on Google App Engine, using DRF and GraphQL for some things. React on the front end.
Oh, okay.
So it's an interesting mix of things, but mostly boilerplate and pretty much what you'd expect if you've seen the tech stack that I've been working with for the last 7 or 8 years.
Well, it scales. We just had Wenbin Fang, who wrote a popular post on the boring tech behind a one-person tech company, was talking about Listen Notes, his company. And I mean, if you can do it, if it works, it works. And
yeah. And when you say boring, you know, or no, you didn't say boring, but when you say like it was pretty vanilla and how you would expect if you knew the stack, but that means you're using it right. You know, you're going with the grain of the wood. You know, you're not fighting it.
Yeah.
And then it does scale. Then it does work.
I mean, that's what David Hennemeyer Hansen was saying with Pride when we talked to him about Ruby on Rails, is that both Shopify and GitHub are now on vanilla Rails, whereas they had custom this and that over the years. But you know, it's a point of pride to be even at their scale on vanilla releases. So maybe that's a relevant question. Django just updated. I'm curious, either at Doctor on Demand or at Apro, how up to date were you all with the Django versions? What were those transitions like? You know, being hands-on.
Yes, I can talk about this now at Doctor on Demand. It was something that I felt like I had to hide for a long time, but it's relevant to.
Were you on 1.5?
No, but it's relevant to the point about vanilla Rails, and it's also relevant to like choosing dependencies carefully. So there was.
Yeah, that's always what it is.
Early on, I was actually like very diligent about keeping up to date with versions. But there was one dependency I was using that needed a patch on something. And so for that reason, we like forked Django, and then we didn't have to after 1.7. But the transition from 1.7 to 1.8 took a very long time. Actually, 1.6 to 1.7, and then 1.7 to 1.8 took a long time. Yes. So going from, and it was because this library that I chose, which it was an address library that, you know, had a what seemed at the time like a good idea from an architecture standpoint, where you have like a table for countries and for states, and then like everything only has one key, but you end up with like lots of joins. And looking back on it, that's one of the things where I'm just like, yeah, I should have just created an address model with all of the fields and been done with it. because the pain associated with using this third party library and some of the things that digging under the hood later they had chosen to do, and like undoing that after like we were using addresses in all sorts of places, was more painful than it should have been.
Yeah. I hope I didn't already mention this on the podcast, but I told Carlton, someone emailed me the other day, because I get a lot of emails from people learning Django, saying, yeah, Will, which Django apps are good ones to use? How do I tell? And I was like, oh, I sort of love the naivete of that question, but it's such a deep question, because it often is, you know, you install something, you know, when you're prototyping or you need it, and then that's what causes you to come behind on Django. And at least personally, I'm sort of, yeah, I'm always extremely reticent to add any third-party packages to my stuff. If I can, I'll try to reverse engineer it just for this very reason. But that's not a practical mindset. I mean, you just, you know, you sort of want the technical debt, but yeah, you always don't really look under the code until you have to. And
yeah,
I don't know. Carlton, what are your thoughts on this? It's just such an interesting question.
I've been burned so hard so many times for this. Like, I've wept tears of blood over third-party dependencies that I wish I'd never installed. So what
could
would
you
I
have
do?
Known, though?
No.
Could your thought process have been different?
You have to learn. You have to learn why it is that this pip install magic package, like,
yeah,
it's not a good idea, folks. Like, there are what, a dozen or 20 or 30, right, really top-notch, long-term, mature Django packages out there that you just wouldn't, there's no way would you build your own. You just use them because they've got a history, they're reliable, you know, but be cautious. So go on there was a post on the forum.djangoproject.com, the Django forum, which packages do you like? And that is gold dust. There's, you know, people have got...
I started that one.
Right, you still... Well done. But there are, you know, 20 people with, like, different overlaps of their best packages. That was amazing. That's great. Use those packages, but don't, you know, be careful. So, like, you know, there's something came up on Twitter the other day, hash IDs. So for slugs, you want you want a unique ID. I use hash IDs, but I don't use the Django hash IDs project. Not because that might be great. I don't know, but I just won't go near it because I won't take on a dependency that I can't vouch for. And I learned that the hard way.
Yeah, well, we'll link to it. I think the question on the Django forum was top five third-party packages, because I was curious if there was standard overlap. And I think, you know, it quickly becomes really like 10, 15 for most people that they're using on every project. But that is one of the things I think about in terms of, is there a way to shortcut to that without, you know, tears and pain?
To provide a counterpoint, like, I'm still very pro dependency, and there are other dependencies where I'm like so glad that I found them.
Definitely.
There's one called that's, and it's actually not super well known, but it just works. And it's called QR, but I think it's hard to find because
you can't Google for it.
But because there's another package that also has it, and like it looks like. I'll have to find it and put it in the show notes, but it's what I used as a wrapper around Redis queues, and it worked really well. And the whole thing, like, was one of the reasons I didn't have qualms using it either, was the whole thing was like probably like 500 lines of code, and I could like grok it and like see what it was doing. It was like, okay, this is like fine. And I don't have to write this myself. And thank you to the author for like putting this out there, because it was incredibly reliable and an easy to use interface. But yeah, there are libraries that I wouldn't start a project without, but it's, I sort of have this, someone asked me about this once, if I had a philosophy around like what tech I chose to use. And I said something along the lines of like, I like to use things that are new enough that people don't cringe when they hear you're using them, but mature enough that I'm not getting woken up at 2 a.m. more often than necessary.
I think it's a good rule of thumb.
Well, I'm just going to say, I like what you said about like it's only 500 lines, I can grok it. So the sort of cast iron test for a new dependency is, if push comes to shove, if this never gets another commit in its entire thing, could I take this on and maintain this as part of my, mm-hmm. you know, daily job? If I, for the good of this project, in that case, yeah, okay, maybe take it on. But if it's, you know, loads of models and loads of views and loads of stuff, and it's like, is this really what I need for my project?
Yeah. And that was one, actually, I think the dependency that I mentioned is actually one that we upgraded to Python 3 because we used it, and I have to check it. I think they open sourced it.
Is it Django RQ? Is that the one?
It's just called QR. And if you look it up on GitHub, it's TNM/QR. And I was able to find it because it's one of Dr. Anuman's public repos is QR3, which is the Python 3 version of it.
Just before we move on, just like going back to the history of Django, like I think that upgrade period between like 1.5, 1.6, 1.7, 1.8, the whole migrations coming in, and all, that was just a, you know, that was a massive difficult period for a lot of people, a lot of projects. And I think that it sort of marks the difference sort of up to 1.8 and then 1.9, 1.10, 1.11, 2, you know, it's a different world now, right? It's much smoother, much easier.
Yeah.
A sort of change in
And to that point,
maturity level of the framework.
I am actually so grateful that we started with 1.5 and not 1.4, because going from 1.4 to 1.5 would have been painful.
Yeah. So it's a different, like, it's just like a different epoch in Django's history, yeah. Right? Those early days to now.
Yeah. Well, and even 3.0, which just came out, sounds like a big leap from 2.2, but I just updated a whole bunch of projects and it's really not much of a leap.
Oh.
Which is really, really nice. That's how you want it. So thank you, Carlton, Marius, and everyone else for making that happen.
It's the contributors and Tim Graham again for like putting the systems in place such that Django has, you know, the stability that it needs as a mature framework.
Yeah, Jacinda, I wanted to ask you about. So you've given a tutorial on security, I think at least the last two Django cons, and I haven't been able to attend in person, but I've gone through all the slides. It's really fantastic. I wonder if you could just sort of tee that up in terms of, you know, because I think you what is that tutorial like? And I hope you keep doing it, right? In terms of, I think you take a Django app and then ask people to hack it and run through kind of best practices, which are super relevant to, you know, medicine.
Yes. It's one of the things that I actually really like about Django is how seriously they take security. Like even when there was a time period where we were using an unsupported version of Django, we made sure to like backport any security fixes, and keep on top of that. Much better when you're on vanilla and you don't have to worry about that because you get it for free.
Yes.
But the security tutorial is again, another thing that I can't take credit for. It's actually originally, Ashish's tutorial that he gave at PyCon, I want to say 2015. Have to double check. But I was giving a tutorial at PyCon. Yeah, PyCon 2015. I gave a tutorial on the Django admin, actually, which I had also given at DjangoCon 2014, which was my first ever DjangoCon. And I was crazy simultaneously crazy enough to propose a tutorial and a talk, and then the organizers accepted both of them from a first-time presenter. It worked out fine.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we'll link to that talk. That's a fantastic talk because you talk about building out the early version of Doctor on Demand.
But I was giving an admin tutorial at PyCon in 2015, and Ashish had sent out like a request for TAs for a security tutorial he was giving, and I was like, sure, I'd love to help out. It seems like an awesome idea. He set up a deliberately insecure Django web app, and then you go through all of the instances are on Heroku, so you're split up into teams, and there's a short period of lecture where you go through like various pieces of the OWASP top 10, and then your team that you are assigned to has a Heroku instance that you try and like find the vulnerabilities, and you can see like why you're not supposed to use raw SQL and why you shouldn't put CSRF exempt on things, and like how a cross-site scripting attack actually works and what it looks like. And it's a lot of fun because people like will do unexpected things to each other, and like they'll find the vulnerabilities, and then because you're working in a team, like someone will come up with like people who are much better at JavaScript than I am have like crafted their own like fun little things that are surprising for folks. Like someone probably rolled all of the other teammates at one point, which is great. I loved that tutorial, and I like a couple of years later I met Ashish again and like thanked him for doing it. It was like, that was an awesome tutorial, and he mentioned, yeah, I don't have time to work on it anymore, but if you ever want to take it, it's like all open source, you're welcome to like give it yourself. And so I did. I updated it from 1.4 to 1.8 last year. Or no, when I gave it at DjangoCon 2018.
Last year.
And
yeah.
Definitely remember, or maybe it was to 1.11. Regardless, I realized why he hadn't used 1.7, because that was the most recent version, because like Django introduced some stuff that made one of the vulnerabilities much harder to execute.
Oh yeah.
In 1.7. And so I like was banging my head against the wall, like, how can I get this vulnerability to work again? It has to do with like cookie-based session storage and how you can hack that, and like why the Django secret key should remain secret. And so Django has gotten progressively secure, or more secure over the years. And so I remember complaining, it was like, I had to spend so much time to get this vulnerability to work again. And I was talking to James, and he was like, are you really going to complain about Django getting more secure? I was like, well, yes.
But my needs are secure. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Well, and I don't know if either of you know when the deployment checklist that is part of Django that I think we've talked about in the show. I mean, I find that so helpful, right? Because it really is, there is like the dev version and the production version, and for someone who hasn't done it before, like I go into some depth in this in my book, but it's quite a leap to understand what are the differences, and then why would we not just have it be secure all the time, and then it would be one, I love the pen test version of like hack this site, which is I think such a fun way to do these what can be sometimes dry things. And I didn't realize it was actually you just spin up a dedicated Heroku for each site. I mean, I guess you need two accounts, right? Because you only get 5 free accounts from Heroku, but it's doable to do that.
Yeah, I got the, like, I have a paid account, but I don't think I've ever even with the tutorial, having used it, I don't think I've ever had to really pay very much at all for the way it's being used. And all of it is, like, all of the slide content and web app content is all available on GitHub, and so anyone can go through it and like set it up. The basic takeaway of the tutorial is don't override Django's defaults unless you really know what you're doing. And are you really sure that you know what you're doing?
Right. I also wanted to ask you about, I saw this year at PyCon, you gave a talk on speeding up the Django admin.
Oh, yeah.
I guess I'm curious, at what point do you leave the Django admin in terms of playing around with your data and stay in it? Because you showed all these fun optimizations, but with your experience, what's your kind of rule of thumb for when are you abusing the admin and when are you improving it?
You're definitely abusing the admin if it's your primary customer support tool. That's one key indicator.
I forget, did you put, I don't think you, I've seen people like throw Elastic in the search there. I don't recall if you, I remember you showed, you stepped through how to speed up like some queries.
I did not do that, but I know the woman who gave the talk about throwing Elasticsearch in there, and it's quite a good talk. I definitely encourage people to go watch that one as well. I think she gave it at DjangoCon this year.
Well, we'll find it and link to it. But I mean, I loved your presentation because you took like a really slow query and then you kind of stepped through ways to improve it, which I love that teaching approach rather than just giving the answer, because without the context, it's just like some code you've memorized. But I assume that came from some real world examples of using the admin to do lots of stuff.
Oh yeah, the admin is a great way to like get a quick overview of data and like make quick changes. I think the general rule of thumb that the documentation gives, if you're using it primarily for like internal use, then that's great. If it's, I don't want to give like a blanket rule because it's like, it's such a useful tool.
Yeah.
But I think it can get tricky if it's like something that is externally facing. Like that's probably a, you know, I don't want to say blanket bad, but application smell. Maybe like, are you really sure this is a good idea? Kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you can do a lot with permissions. I'll 100% agree. You shouldn't show outside or customers your admin panel. I mean, even you know, basic thing.
Like the clue is the user model, right? It's got an is star flag, and if you're not staff, you can't log into the admin by default, right? So go with that.
If everyone is staff, you might be doing something wrong.
Right, but you know, if internal side, internal app, you know.
Well, I mean, because you might have, I don't know, customer support versus engineers. Some people can do reads, some people can do.
The addition of view permissions, I think, was really nice from the perspective of, I don't know, depending on your perspective, either making the admin more flexible and more useful for more people, but safer, or from the perspective of like just encouraging people to quote unquote abuse it more. I don't know. That's potentially one of those, like, we could go down a deep rabbit hole here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think on some level you have to take responsibility. If you have enough knowledge to customize the admin, go for it. I mean, not go for it, but like, you know, it's a little bit how I feel like when people ask me about like setting things up at computers and they're using Linux. It's like, well, you're in Linux world. Like, I exempted yourself into a different category.
Without sounding trite, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. I was going to say on the admin, and this just came up 2 days ago. The thing, if I could solve one thing, it's like, don't have your admin at /admin. Like, I was looking at some somewhat prominent Django company and I was like, I wonder if admin's exposed. Yeah, it's exposed. And then I was like, you know, doing password, you know, so change that. Like, I would rather you give outside access to your admin than have /admin personally. Carlton, you agree?
I just think I'm
it's so easy to change.
I'm just imagining
it's so easy
like
to change.
Instagram.com/admin. Like, whatever.
Well, and I mean, I just really judge harshly. It's a little unfair, but I looked at that as like, nope, they just dropped a whole bunch of notches. Like, you got to change that. Anyway, sorry, your talk, though, I think you focused a lot on queries, right? On speeding up, I forget the schema that you were dealing with
in
that talk.
An alternate title for that talk could be like basic usage of Django Debug Toolbar for analyzing queries. And it just happens to be really easy to like demonstrate that against the admin, because it's very easy to create ON queries when using the list view.
So one other talk that you've given that isn't technical, I think, was on becoming a parent. And I'm curious if we'll link to that if you could share, you know, the non-technical side of being a coder.
Yeah, I think being a programmer has been simultaneously like a huge blessing when becoming a parent, because it's fortunate that it's a job that in some cases can be more flexible. And I was really fortunate that at Doctor on Demand, the culture was such that like I was able to have an extremely flexible working schedule, especially after my daughter was born. And so in that talk, I discussed some of the things that like I totally didn't expect becoming a parent. And it's different from most of the other talks that I've given that you'll find. My daughter actually ended up on stage towards the end of that talk, because she was 10 months old and she was being held in the front row for a good portion of the talk. And then she decided that she was just not happy there anymore.
I've had enough of this. Yeah.
Oh, okay. You know what? I have seen this talk then. Yeah. Programming post-progeny. Cause I do remember that talk. And actually I love that. I think you generally bring her to the conferences, cause I've seen you at a number of conferences that you're there. Cause it actually makes me feel like, oh man, I should have brought my kids too.
Oh, she definitely comes along to a lot of conferences, and it's been really fun as she's gotten older and like different things. The expos are always a really good time. That's one of the things that coming for the language and staying for the community has been a big part of Python and Django for me. Like when I started, it was because I appreciated like the technical aspects of it. And now going to the conferences is also for me like just a connection with a really fantastic group of people that I love being around.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think too, I mean, just for me, like I'm now my second year of going to conferences, they just get more fun, because then you already know people and you you still meet new people. But yeah, it's a very welcoming community.
Right. Jacinda, thank you very much for coming on the show. What a super chat. Everything, technical details, all the way through to community and family and life and things like that. So super.
Yes. Thank you for
thank you so much for having me and for like having a podcast for the community, and definitely very much appreciate all the people who spend time putting out content for people.
Well, thank you for sharing your stack too, because I think we're not afraid to dive into the details, because for people listening, it is interesting.
Thank you so much. And I hope you have a great rest of your day.
And you. That was Django Chat. We're on Twitter at Chat Django, and join us next time. Bye-bye.